Geld dazu. Mhm. Oh, okay. Can you talk more about Bhati and Anubhati? That chant, Natatra Suryo Bhati Nachandra Tarakam Nema Vidyato Bhanti Kato Yamagnihi. Yeah, Tameva Bhantam Anubhati Sarvam Bhati Anubhati. So Bhati, the word Bhati means that which shines, that which is actually something which is shining of its own accord, Bhati. Everything, the only thing that shines of its own accord, that's its own light, is in the end the Atma, the Self. Anubhati is that which shines after that. Now, after is not in terms of before, and after is a time sequence. Doesn't mean that. But Anu means, the Anubhati means that shining is dependent upon this shining. Means it is not self-evident. In Sanskrit, we use this term swata siddha. Swataha means self, of its own, on its own. Siddha means established, evident. By itself, everything in the creation is not swata siddha. It's not self-evident. It requires a pramana, a means of knowledge for it to be known. Right? So without the utilization of a means of knowledge, it doesn't shine. It doesn't shine of its own accord. So, like for instance, through my eyes, say if I'm looking at all of you, what happens is through my eyes, my mind then gains a thought modification, right, of the form of whatever I'm perceiving at this moment through my eyes. I gain a thought modification. And that thought modification then is illumined, shines after the knownness of the self. So let me just explain that. We talked a little bit about this today. Yourself is swata siddha. It's self-evident. I could get rid of the whole creation, all time and space, all duality, and still this me experience is going to be there. That's swata siddha. Because there's nothing in the creation that is contributing to that self-experience. It's not like my mind needs to be focused on me so the self can be known. It's because of the self that the mind is known, right? So the self is swata siddha, and so now in reference to the vritti, the thought modification, that thought modification enjoys the knownness or the self-evident nature, right, of the self. So the self, because of the self, that is illumined, right? It's not illumined by itself, you know. It needs to be illumined. And so everything in the creation requires a pramana, a means of knowledge, to give me a vritti of it, and the vritti, the thought modification, then as though reflects or is illumined by consciousness. So it shines after consciousness. Because consciousness is there, then it can be known. It is dependent on being known on the consciousness. So now the way I was talking about that today is when we were saying, you know, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, I am known. The I am knownness doesn't require anything other than my being. It is known because I am consciousness. So the is-known experience is the consciousness experience. There's no subject-object there. Consciousness, by its very swarupa, by its very nature, is self-evident because it's consciousness. Right? It's not a knower. Knower requires a mind or sense organs, but consciousness is just self-shining me. Right? So it's self-evident. But everything else other than consciousness requires consciousness to light it up as though. But we can say it in even more deeply, which we were doing today. Everything in this creation is mithya, right? In fact, we can't really find a thing here. But if we recognize all of this just from today's talk, that everything that we perceive, everything that exists within duality is mithya. That means that it must have an adhishtana. And the adhishtana, right, is the sat-chit, is conscious being. Conscious being is self-evident. And that self-evident nature in our language translates as is known. Like, I am known not because anybody knows me, but because I am self-evident consciousness. So my experience of my being as me as is known not because it's illumined, but because I'm consciousness, I'm self-evident. Okay? And that self, that so I naturally enjoy joy without a knower known relationship is knownness. So I can say, I am known, this is known, this is known, this is known, I am known. Okay? But when I say, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, all of these things are known because I have a vritti, because I have pramanas, means of knowledge like my eyes or my ears, or the means of knowledge available to me to give me a thought modification. Right, which then is known, the thought modification is known, okay? But this is the thing. The is-knownness that's attributed to the thought modification actually is the nature of the self. Remember that any thought or anything in the creation is mithya, okay? That means it has no being, kind of like the pot totally enjoys the nature of the clay. Totally, right? What part of the pot doesn't enjoy the nature of the clay? So what part of the vritti, that thought modification, doesn't enjoy me? And so the is-knownness, I am its self. So because of the superimposition, what happens is that somehow I think that the thought is known. Or the perception is known, that the is-knownness belongs to the perception. But the is-knownness doesn't belong to the perception. It's the very nature of the self. But what happens, because of ignorance, I identify myself with this body, mind, sense organs, and I take myself to be a conscious being. Why? Because I am a conscious being. Because that's who I am. I take myself to be a conscious being. So when I have a thought modification, that's of, you know, the wood and the rug and all this. I don't take myself to be the wood and the rug and all of these things that I'm perceiving. I take myself to be the conscious being, right? And so in reference to the thought modification in my mind that is given to me through my sense organs, say, then I take myself in that thought modification. I identify with the consciousness, the one who is conscious of the objects. And I construct, you know, a knower known relationship there, because I identify with the consciousness, not with the wall, right? So then I become the one who is the knower of the wall, like that, because I only know the wall because my sense organs. So this knowership is a construct in a way, because in the actuality of my experience, there is no experience of a knower. There's only the experience of everything being known. But the only thing that is known in and of itself from its own swarupa, from its own nature, is conscious being. That's self-evident. Everything else shines after that. In other words, if it comes in contact with self-evident me, then it shines. If it doesn't come in contact with self-evident me, it doesn't shine. So that's what they mean by it shines after me. It must come in contact with me to enjoy the is-knownness. Because I am the is-knownness, not it. That's the idea there. Does that work at all? Mm. Not quite?
Yeah.
You have to sit with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we use the sun as an example, because the sun, within duality, the sun is self-evident. I mean, it's self-shining. You don't have to bring in another sun to illumine it. It's the luminary. And so everything that shines, see, bhati means it shines, it presents itself. Right? We say it presents itself. That's what they mean by shining. We don't have this word in English. Now that I'm lit up by the lamp, so I'm presenting myself to you. You can see me. So I'm bhati. But the only reason I'm bhati, I'm shining, I can present myself to you, is because of something else, because of the lamp. Because this body, mind, sense organs is not self-shining. Of course, that's only an example, because we can go farther and say, and in fact, consciousness, without my eyes, I'm not aware of the lamp. And without consciousness, my eyes don't shine. So it all resolves back into consciousness. But still, it's useful to see the sun is bhati because it's shining of its own accord. Everything else is anubhati because it's depending on the sun for it to shine. The sun is the luminary. So in reference to this knowledge, I am the luminary. In reference to the whole creation, including the sun, I am the luminary as the is-knownness that is provided to the creation, and everything shines after that. Without me, there is nothing known. So if I say, without me, there is nothing known, everything else is anubhati, it depends upon me. So if you take anu more in the sense, instead of after, shines after me, like, well, what shines before me then? So, you know, before and after. So mm-hmm. Take it more as it depends upon me. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So. I am. I am consciousness, conscious being that is not changing. Is that the same as my essence, love, peace, joy, strength, etc.? Is it not my conscious being that is observing the thoughts, the emotions, everything that is coming and going? Or is it buddhi? Okay. Okay, so the amness, my own beingness, is consciousness, sat, being, the amness, which is consciousness, chit, which is ananda, sat, chit, ananda. Those are that's the lakshana, that's used, the definition for my own nature. Lakshana means it can't be used on anything else. That's what makes something a lakshana. It's also implied meaning, but here lakshana has this meaning of this. There's nothing else can be defined in this way. It is existence, which is consciousness, which is ananda, which is limitless. That limitless is often talked about as fullness or wholeness or absolute well-being or absolute love. But in fact, what your nature is, these words are simply pointing to it, because like love, peace, joy, strength, all of these words, they are kind of different in themselves, but they can be used to point to your nature, but you have to recognize your nature to say, oh, that's why they say love, or that's why they say strength, that's why they say shanti or peace. Because these words are all used within the world and they have slightly different meanings, and you can have a lot of shanti that then is replaced by agitation. So all of the experiences that we have in the world are variegated and of different levels of intensity. For instance, I can feel love, but then I can feel an overwhelming absolute love. I could feel it in the form of great compassion or just gentleness. There's so many subtle differences, and those variants are all dependent upon the mind, the condition of the mind. The mind can be more subtle or less subtle, more agitated or less agitated, and that gives all different types of experience in the positive spectrum, all different types of experiences of love or well-being. And so we have words for all of those differences, and we can use those words to point to your own nature, right? But then as we're using it as a pointer, we have to strip off the kind of the time-bound and qualitatively changing nature of the word, but use it as something which resonates with my own being. So we have to do the same with a word like existence or my own amness. We have to take off from my sense of being everything that makes it limited or mortal, you know? Because if I know, well, yeah, I am, but I'm only here as long as my body's here. You know, if I take myself to be the mind, I'm continually changing. You know, there's nothing really very stable about me, you know, but I am consciousness. So I think, you know, well, my mind is conscious. I am a conscious being. But of course, I'm always changing. And that same thing with I am full or complete sometimes, but that's also always changing. So we have to handle these words in such a way as to break through, tear off the duality, you know, take off the duality of the meaning, and just have it land on your own self. But in the end, really, the nature of yourself is recognized or is known in the recognition of yourself. And it is something when you recognize your own nature, you realize all of these words are pointers. They are all used to point to that self, because my self is so strong. Nothing can move it, because there's no place to go. I'm infinite. There's no outside. So I couldn't be more stable. I couldn't be more strong. And my self is an absolute shanti. There's nothing that can ruffle it, no matter what's going on in the world or what's going on in my mind. That shanti peace is absolute. And that sense of absolute well-being, there's no way, as you recognize yourself, you don't want it to be different. You can't conceive of it being different, and you don't want it to be different. It can't be different, and you don't want it to be different. You want it just to be just exactly as it is, because it can't be improved upon. And it's also it's not a bliss vritti either. It's just very down-to-earth, simple me that is so beautiful. You know, and so all of the words, so let's say, so it says, is that sat chit the same as love, peace, joy, strength? Yes, it is. But those words are pointing to what we mean by those words. Do you understand what I mean? Like, you are an absolute strength, but it's not muscular strength. It's a strength that I can't be displaced or changed or hurt in any way. It's impossible. But then I recognize that's true, you know. And I can't be flustered in any way. Nothing can be done. I am ananda. I am complete fullness. That's my nature. So all of these words point to that very beautiful nature that is me. And all of the words are limited by, like all words are limited by, being defining something in duality, as that is subject to change and decay and coming and going. So, now, is it not my conscious being that is observing the thoughts, the emotions, everything that is coming and going? Or is it the buddhi? Okay, so now, the idea we have that something is being observed. Okay? But what is actually happening, like observed, is though the Atma itself is watching or looking or aware of, right? If you say observed, say you have a vritti, an emotion, or whatever it is, that the Atma is aware of that. So observing that, seeing that, experiencing that. Say, no, it's not that. If that were true, say that were true, that the Atma had as its nature knowership, or had the quality of being aware of, then how come we're not all aware of the same thing all of the time, you know? Like, you're aware of a whole different set of things, and I'm aware of a whole different set of things at this moment, every one of us. We're aware of different things. So if there's only one self, how can that one self not have all experiences? Or how come that one self as a knower, if there's only one non-dual self, is not Ishvara, aware of the whole creation, you know? So then each one would have to have their own self, which has some quality of being a knower. So what is actually happening here is that each mind is different. Each buddhi is different. For every individual, you have your own mind and your own buddhi. And that buddhi, right, because it is sattva, now, I don't know if we'll have time, maybe we'll see, to get into sattva, rajas, and tamas. Maybe I can do it. Maya is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas. And they're like the three strands that make up maya. Sattva is that which reflects or enjoys, which manifests intelligence or consciousness. It's a material, the material of maya. Sattva means that which reflects or manifests consciousness. Rajas is that which is responsible for all energy, all types of motion and activity. And tamas is responsible for the physical creation. It's actually the subtle elements go through a process of, it's called becoming fivefold in order to be differentiated from the subtle world. So that's done through tamas. So maya as having the sattva, rajas, and tamas, the one aspect of maya, the sattva, allows for the manifestation of consciousness. So if I hold up a rock in a mirror to the sun, right? They're both inert, they're both maya, say. They're both inert. But the rock and the sun are both, the rock and the mirror, they're both illumined by the sun, right? And they're both warmed by the sun, but only the mirror reflects the sun. That's the differentiation. If you have a subtle body, if your upadi, this conditioning adjunct, has a subtle body, that has a mind, the subtle body will have a mind, as sattva. It will reflect or allow consciousness to manifest in it where a rock won't. Right? And so now, because I have a mind that is made of the sattva, the consciousness that illumines that mind is also as though manifest in the mind. So consciousness isn't doing anything. But it's just like the mirror. You know, the sun isn't doing anything when the mirror reflects it. It's not the sun saying, oh, let me be reflected now, or, you know, let me go into that mirror and be manifest in the mirror. It's just because of the nature of the mirror that happens. So because of the nature of sattva, the mind which is made of sattva, as though reflects or manifests consciousness or something that isn't sattva, like a rock or a rug, it still has for its nature consciousness, but from its own standpoint, it doesn't manifest it. So say, for instance, if you have a dream, the whole dream, the entire dream, because sattva, rajas, and tamas will go through the entire dream is known, has manifest consciousness, and that's why if you're dreaming, so you're not looking at the dream from within it, from the sense organs and whatnot, there's no one you're identified with in the dream, then just the whole dream is known. That's because of sattva, right? The sattva as though manifests consciousness. What does it manifest? From its own standpoint, it manifests is knownness. As I said earlier, there is no experience of a knower or an observer. There's the experience of things being known, right? And so since things are known, then I'm the knower, because I have sense organs and a mind, etc. But you actually don't have an experience of a knower. You have an experience of things being known. And then you figure out, well, how is it that this is known? Well, because I have sense organs and a mind, and I'm a conscious being, so therefore I am the knower, and these things are the known. That's a rationalization and trying to make sense of your experience. But the experience is actually just that everything is known. And so, I just want to make sure I don't get too far away from the question. So no, it is not my conscious being that is observing the thoughts, but, you know, and the comings and goings of all experience, but it is my conscious being because of which all of these experiences are known. And the experiences that are known are because they have come into the mind in the form of a vritti, which is sattva. Because there's all kinds of things going on that are not known to you at this moment. They're known to Ishvara, because sattva pervades the whole creation, so they're all known to Ishvara. But the only things that are going to be known to you to enjoy that is knownness are things that come into your mind as a vritti. It can come in from unconscious material, They can be emotions, they can be memories, whatever, they can be meditative experiences, but a vritti, thought modification, is required for that whatever is taking place to enjoy that is-knownness. There's no is-knownness without the vritti other than the self-evident is-knownness of my being, swatta siddha. My being is self-evident. So it is known without any pramana. Everything else requires the mind and sense organs, you know, including meditative experiences. Does that make sense? Anyway. This is it. It's a very good question. And this particular question, when it's understood, you really understood this, you've gone a long way in Vedanta, because it's very fundamental understanding. This is pretty. Spontaneity could mean reacting inappropriately or hurting, or it could mean showing up as oneself with lightness and cheerfulness. How to draw a wise line to make the difference when it is right, dharmic, to be spontaneous, and when it is right not to be spontaneous, and better, and to control oneself. Yeah. You know, we have natural, I would say, natural inbuilt safeguards. We have a natural inbuilt knowledge of dharma, adharma. We don't really need to be taught. The only problem is that we have a natural understanding of what is good, ahimsa, non-injurious, helpful, caring behavior, you know, by knowing how we want to be treated. I understand dharma in the way that I want to be treated. Now the thing is that we also know that if I want to be treated this way, all beings probably want to be treated this way. It's a universal. We know that too. But nothing gets by raga dveshas, my likes and dislikes, don't get in the way of how I want you to treat me. Because I always want you to treat me well. I want you to be kind to me, to give me the benefit of the doubt, to respect me, to not hurt me, to come to my rescue when I need you. You know, all of those things, of course, I expect you as a good human being, as a dharmic human being, to do all of these things. Because that's what's the right thing to do. I'm very clear on it. And I know that for myself also. So we all always have that underlying value system. It's built in just because of my own self-experience of knowing how I want to be treated. But my raga dveshas, my likes and dislikes, my needs to be happy that are superimposed on the creation. Like I need things to be a certain way. I need you to be a certain way. I need to have this and that and this and that in order for me to be happy. And so sometimes those needs cover over or make dharma take a backseat because those needs overshadow how my ability to put dharma first in reference to you. Even though I always put dharma first in reference to me. But to put dharma first in reference to you, sometimes my desires put that into a back seat. And then what we might call spontaneity is not really spontaneity. I don't know that I would call it. I think spontaneity, we don't usually use that word spontaneity in reference to cruelty or to anger. Oh, yeah, I was just being spontaneous. Just wipe that person out. It just came from me. I don't think so. You don't think of spontaneity in that way, you know? we feel like we lost control of ourselves because we behaved in a way that we ourselves would never want to be treated. So we don't consider that as spontaneity. We consider that more like I lost myself. You know, my buddhi was pushed to the side because of my desire. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse on this. It starts with desire that becomes thwarted, that causes krodha. You know, there's the kama, the desire. It's thwarted in some way or another, which causes krodha, which causes brahma, anger. Krodha is anger, which then causes delusion. In that delusion, you can do and say anything. Why do you go crazy? It can drive you crazy. So Shankara, in his commentary on this, says, you can even say unkind, rude words to your guru. Which is just, you know, just unheard of. You cannot do that. You can even speak out and say some unkind or disrespectful things to your teacher. You can even do that, you know. And so this krodha, these thwarted desires, destroy the buddhi, they destroy the person. That's the verse. There's two lines. That's what that particular verse says. And so that krodha or thwarted desire causes you to act out. And then you can call that spontaneous, I would say inappropriately, because the acting, the pressure that you feel to act out is not something that your buddhi comes in and checks. The shama and dhamma, you know? It's a failing of dhamma. Shama means, in terms of kind of qualities, shama is when the thoughts and feelings that come through your mind, you have a choice to let them go or to act on them. So that means that if it's something, a thought that is not really worthwhile for you to bother with, you can just let it continue on. But dhamma is where you get caught by your thought, or an emotion is coming through that catches you. It becomes like embodied. And then you have an impulse to strike out or to say something mean or do something. But you have the dhamma means you have the capacity to contain that, right? And so we wouldn't say, well, I had a desire and it was thwarted and so I just spontaneously spewed all over the place. We don't use that word spontaneous. You see what I mean? Right? The pressure was so much I couldn't control that behavior. So spontaneous you can look at it as something that takes place within Dharma. And then that's a beautiful thing that we enjoy that spontaneity and everybody enjoys it because there's certain lightness and beauty to it. So that's how I would differentiate it, just in how we normally use the language. Right. What is the consciousness and how is it related to Ishvara? Well, what is the consciousness? There's no way to answer that exactly. There's something there to be seen because you know yourself as a conscious being as opposed to inert, right? So if I asked you, are you inert? You'd say, no. Are you unconscious? You would say, no. I'm not unconscious. I'm not inert. Are you conscious? Yes, I'm conscious. Well, what do you mean by consciousness? So when we say, I am a conscious being or I'm conscious, we know what we mean kind of experientially, that I'm not inert, that I'm aware, you know, that I'm an aware human being. But of course, the word consciousness is always seen through the lens of the body and the mind and the sense organs or any of the upadis which enjoy consciousness. So we don't recognize consciousness per se, but it's with the teaching that we start to recognize that, well, everything that I thought consciousness was produced consciousness or consciousness belonged to is actually objectified and comes and goes in consciousness. And so now my mind is directed to recognizing the nature of consciousness in and of itself, not in relationship or through a given conditioning adjunct like the body or the mind or the sense organs. So it's not a question of being able to hold up consciousness and, well, this is consciousness, in reference to something else, because there is no objectification of consciousness. The only reason I know it is because I am it. And then to know what it really, what I really am, is to strip it off of all of the things that have been falsely superimposed upon it. And then you know, in that way, you know what consciousness is. And then it says, and how is it related to Ishvara? Okay. Consciousness is what we call, the Atma is consciousness, which is Brahman, which is infinite. And consciousness itself is just pure, non-dual, conscious being. There's no duality, there's no subject-object relationship there. But consciousness with Maya, because Maya actually has its being in consciousness, and consciousness is non-dual, there's nothing outside of consciousness, so Maya has its being in consciousness. And is totally dependent, because mithya, it's totally dependent on consciousness for its being. When I'm talking about Ishvara, I'm talking about being Brahman and Maya. So Maya is something which cyclically manifests and goes into unmanifest condition. It's mithya, so it doesn't, just like my mind is mithya, my body is mithya, the whole creation is mithya, but that whole creation, which is made of Maya, is rooted in or has its being in Brahman. And so that is Ishvara. Brahman with the Maya Upadi, Upadi means conditioning agent, that is Ishvara. We say Ishvara is the Lord, is God. Because it's not the same Judeo-Christian God. You know, it's, when we think of God, it's, I don't know, for my mother it was a God in heaven in the clouds with angel wings. So it just depends on, you know, your how you were raised or whatever. It, but so it's not a God in heaven and with angel wings. It's this whole infinite creation as on every level as being a manifestation of conscious being. So the universe itself is like an infinite mind. Like your mind, any thought modification you have is known. Right? The whole thing, every part of it, the whole thing as one entity is known. So the whole infinite creation as one entity is known. And the knownness that it enjoys is Brahman, is the self. And so Ishvara is the whole as a, seen as a conscious being. The whole creation is a conscious being because it enjoys consciousness. Does that make sense? We have to talk a little bit more about all of that, which we should be able to do this time. So consciousness is the self of Ishvara, just like the consciousness is yourself. Remember, consciousness is not something that can be objectified. So consciousness doesn't exist in time and space. Time and space exists in consciousness. You know, that's the difference. Who is it that talks to the inner child? Who is the inner child? Well, the one who talks to the inner child is the buddhi, or I would say the observing ego, if you want to say, use a psychological term. And so I can, just like I can talk with you, can direct my attention to you and talk to you, I can also direct my attention into the unconscious and then talk to whoever is there. Like say, sometimes when I'm giving a guided meditation, I'll ask you to say, just direct your attention toward inward, toward your unconscious, or toward any subtle feelings that are there. Direct and say, does anyone inside have anything to say? You're directing inward and you're asking, does anyone have anything to say? And sometimes many little ones will raise their hand, I do, I have. And then you have to decide who you're going to talk to, like that. So they will answer. And very often they will answer. So who you're addressing are, from kind of a more Jungian standpoint, like Carl Jung, you're addressing parts of your, what were once parts of your conscious mind, your experiences that you had when you were little, that got, by the defense system, got taken away and shoved into the unconscious because they were too much for your little mind to handle. It was too hurtful, too shocking, too painful, whatever. And so they were sequestered. It's like the defense system, as it comes, it takes care, because you can't take care of yourself really very much. You don't have logic or anything till you're 6 or 7 years old. And so the defense system, your psyche has a defense system which handles all of the things which you can handle and can't handle. It just makes that determination. You know, if something shocks too much. And sometimes you see if a child goes through something, if the parent gets really mad, all of a sudden the child is like this and then just glazes over and then starts playing again. The defense system came in, too much. And then it puts it, sequesters it there in the unconscious, where it stays. And the defense system keeps it there, protects it there. But what that means is, and this happens, you know, in several different ways. So we have a lot of things stored in our unconscious that were too much for us to handle, especially depending upon our upbringing. Some people have different experiences growing up. Some people had, it was pretty tough, you know, for whatever reason. It's just different for everybody, you know. And so a lot of these little traumas are sequestered with some libido, some psychic energy is being held in the unconscious. So it's like a little piece of yourself. Yourself means not the Atma, but a little piece of your mind. You know, that experience is being held there. And so when your buddhi turns inward toward the unconscious and addresses them, you know, does anyone have anything to say? The buddhi, and it comes in gently with love, then all of those, you'll find those parts getting really kind of excited. You know, sometimes they're afraid, you feel different affect, you know, affects going on. And then you'll just go and be patient, and sometimes they'll talk to you, sometimes they'll just be deep feeling and you sit there with them. Sometimes you hold them because they can't talk, they're too young. It's just all kinds of things that go on in that imaginal realm. But why it's much more than just an fanciful realm, imaginal realm, it's coming out of the affects, you know, the sequestered feelings that have been suppressed and held in the unconscious. And so then you can have a dialogue. They'll actually talk to you. Those sequestered feelings can produce images, you know, and can go and get into conversation with you because they're a little part of yourself. And eventually, if you stay with them, the energy that has been sequestered, that meant little piece, mind piece that's been sequestered, will join back into the conscious mind. And you feel it, too. You feel that part of you, that little girl part of you, rejoining you. You know? It's really a beautiful thing. And so these, what we call the inner child, we say inner child because these sequestered parts of ourselves normally happen when you're a child because you don't have the capacity yet to take care of it yourself or to logic it out or to have a conversation about it. And there's no, you're not ready for that. And so then we can go in and rescue those parts, and it feels, the insight, the unconscious feels so happy. Those little ones, if you come into contact with, they feel such relief. It's like somebody's come to get me. Somebody loves me, you know. Somebody's going to help me. Because otherwise it's just sitting in there with all those feelings. And the only way that those feelings are really expressed is by projection. They'll project out, you know, usually in the form of a dyad. Like say if you had a traumatic relationship with your father, for instance, so that, say, your father-daughter or father-son, difficult relationship. Then what happens is that trauma, whatever it was, is that any given trauma is stored inside. And in fact, other similar traumas will go into the same place. And then what will happen is that somebody outside maybe looks at you or says something gruffly, like, that in the same kind of way, something similar to how your father would say, then the father is projected onto that person, and then you are the other half of the dyad, the little girl or the little boy. Then you feel like you used to feel when you were 3 years old or 4 years old, those emotions. Then what's really even, I'd say, awful in a way, is sometimes someone is acting like the little girl or little boy in such a way that you get superimposed on that. The little girl or little boy gets superimposed on that person, and you take on the mean father. And you feel toward that person in the abusive way that your father or mother used to feel toward you. So it can go either way, you know. And so when these type of things are happening, what one thing that we can do, which hopefully we'll get to in the meditation, you have to go in and have a, you know, ask, you know, does anyone have anything to say? Or if you have, whenever you have an emotion, like say somebody hurt your feelings or you're feeling emotional in a way that seems a little bigger than the situation really, you know, should be invoking, you just go inside and be with that emotion. And you talk to it and say, what's this really about? What's really hurting you? Tell me. Just tell me what it is. And it'll tell you. And you can be with that and listen to what it has to say. And then you can say, you know, this is what happened when you were little. This person's not doing that. This is what happened with you and your dad or you and your mom or whatever it is. You remember how you used to feel that way? No, he's not doing that. So you just start having a conversation after you really understand how they're feeling. That relieves a lot of the stuff that's been held there inside. And that's how we have to do it. Otherwise, it's very hard to bring all of that out, because it's sitting there in the unconscious and it naturally comes out through projection, and then we believe the projection. Projections are really real. You know, when a projection happens, it's really hard to even tell yourself that that's not the truth, because you know it is. You know for sure. You're positive. Because the feeling is real. The feeling is real. Nobody can say the feeling isn't real. The feeling is real. It's just a projection because it's landing on a situation that doesn't deserve those feelings. But you can't. No one will say that the feelings aren't real. The feelings are there. I mean, they're real within Vyavahara, within this duality. You are really having that feeling. And so you have to be able to say, when some of these deeper, harder, you know, traumas project out, you have to be able to say something like this: even though I'm positive, even though I'm absolutely positive, this is real. This is what's going on here. And positive, still, it could be a projection. Even though I know it's not, still, it is possible for it to be a projection. And that gives you this little kind of tiny little window, you know? Could be. And then, you know, that's happened to me, especially in the different points in my life where I was certain about some certain things. And then I would find out that it wasn't true at all. It just wasn't true. It's not what was happening. And for sure it wasn't. And I would be so shocked, because I can't tell you how absolutely positive I was. I had no doubt at all. But after that happened to me consciously, where I consciously realized that, you know, several times, then I said to myself, it's kind of a, what do you call it? I forget what you called it. Anyway, I'll think of it. But I said to myself, when this auto-suggestion, I made an auto-suggestion, next time I'm going to realize, tell myself that even though I'm absolutely positive, it still could be a projection. And so then, from then I did do that, you know. And I would still do it now if I'm aware of some projection. Because by the nature of projection, if it's a projection, it is real, you know. It won't be happening otherwise. You won't get to have the projection. It's like if with the rope snake, you can't decide, oh, let me project a snake on the rope. Not going to happen. It's an unconscious process, you know. So then your buddhi has to know this, have this little space, you know. So, and then if you have that little space, then you can work on yourself and go inside and talk to the emotion and things and ask, you know, what's going on. Yeah, so. Okay, we've got a few more minutes. We might not finish our staff. Could you... Well, this is probably the wrong one. Okay, this is the first how this starts out. Could you unfold thoroughly? There we have the problem. Okay, so let's see. Because I'm sure that I can do it. I don't know if we have time. Could you unfold thoroughly the following point? On the one hand, we need to process our emotions, welcome them, stay with them gently as an inner friend, take the unconscious to consciousness. Right? On the other hand, we are not our emotions, our unconscious, or changing thoughts. Therefore, what is exactly the point of working on our emotions and unconscious if we are not them? Wouldn't it be useful to simply learn to disidentify from them? Do we take care of emotions only until we recognize that we are not them or yourself? We need always to work on them.
Yeah.
Okay, that's nice. In this world, you have a body, mind, sense organs. You have this upadi. Upadi means something. The upadi means a conditioning adjunct. It means something I can take myself to be. Like I take myself to be this body because the body enjoys consciousness. So if from the standpoint of the body, I am the body. From the standpoint of the mind, I am the mind. From the standpoint of the sense organs, I am the sense organs. Just like the clay is the pot. Right? Even though I recognize now, I know myself as free of all of that. Still, as long as I have this body, mind, sense organs, right, this is me. There's a natural identification there. Not an identification built of ignorance, but a natural identification of this body reflecting, manifesting consciousness. It's not like you gain self-knowledge and all of a sudden this body and mind and sense organs are no longer conscious being, or that you're not aware of them anymore. You are. It's the same. Except that now you've recognized the fullness and changelessness of yourself, and you still have all of the experiences, the body, mind, sense organs. So now I can say, now that I know that this body is not me, you know, why take care of it? Now that I know that it's not me and I break my arm, let it be broken. What the heck? It's not me. It doesn't matter, you know. So now that I know that this mind and my emotions are not me, why just not dismiss them? Now this is the thing. If you can dismiss them, if you can do that, because that's shama. Certain thoughts and emotions and things are passing through. You choose not to engage. You just don't want to go there. That means that particular emotion has not grabbed you, you know, and you have a choice of going there or bouncing down that road or not. There's some sort of a choice there, and you can choose not to engage. I think that all of us have things passing through that we just decide, no, I don't need to go there, and you just move on. Okay. So those aren't the types of thoughts, feelings, emotions that we're talking about. They're no problem. There are other types of emotions and complexes inside, emotions that rise up and cause me a tremendous amount of grief and pain, you know. And if you say, move on, they don't move. They say, no. They don't want to move on. They need you, you know. It's not, they're rooted, they have some depth and they have some tentacles there. They're rooted in probably unconscious traumas. And so they don't want to move on. They want to be taken care of, you know. Then what are you going to say? No, you're not real, move on, I'm not going to take care of you. You know, but that's that doesn't feel very right. That doesn't feel right, and it doesn't work either. Like, say you had a child, your little child, you know, is all of a sudden, you know, acting out and creating and feeling terrible and angry, and somebody hurt her feelings, and she's all really upset, and she wants you to come and help her and hold her and talk to her and take care of her, and you say, that was not real. It doesn't mean anything. For heaven's sakes, go to your room, please. Just move on. Just move on. And she doesn't want to move on, and she's also now, she's re-traumatized. Right? You've put a layer of trauma on your little child who is already really hurting and traumatized. All she wants is for you to bring her to yourself, you know, and listen, you know, and understand, you know, and let her cry and do all the things that she needs to do with you loving her. That's what she needs, or he needs. And then they go through all of that, you know, and then that, you know, will clear up. And sometimes it, if the trauma's really hurt, it takes a while, you know. But it will clear up because she has you, you know, and she has the love and the care and somebody who really tries to understand and listens well, you know, and then she'll become okay. And your unconscious is like that too. It requires that love and care. It doesn't want to be dismissed. The thoughts that we can dismiss and the emotions, when you dismiss them, they could care less. Or you don't want to pay attention to, that's fine. Just off we go. You know, that's a non-issue. But, you know, there's things about your body you ignore also. Like, say your leg's a little sore or something, it's okay. Because if you don't pay any attention, you don't take it to a doctor and take care of it and do all of this. There's other things about your body that they do require some attention. You have to give that attention. They want it. They don't just move on. Psyche's like that too. It doesn't. The unconscious is like that. It needs your time and care. And the people in your life are like that too. Sometimes, you know, in the relationships that you have, you can kind of just take them for granted and everything's fine and my friend or my partner's doing this and doing that and doing this and I'm doing this, that, and everything's fine, there's no problem. But then there can be a time when someone, one of you, has a problem. There's an issue, there's something, you know. And then you need your partner to give you some attention. You know? Or you need to give your partner some attention. That's how it is. So you can't say, you know, your problems are not real. You really don't need attention. Move on. Move on. Get back to the fundamental problem. And you just sit there. Because, but I'll tell you what, that get back to the, because this Pujaswamiji uses fundamental problem, topical problem, that we were taught with that, and it's very, very useful. But some things, you can't just move on like that. Because those parts are requiring some attention from you, you know. And it's the same in your life. You can't, some things really require, some things, your children, your pets, your partners, your friends. Sometimes everything's just moving along and, you know, take it or leave it. It doesn't matter. It's just fine. It's fine. But it's not always like that. Sometimes your love and attention and being present is required. And that's true also internally. Sometimes your love and attention and being present and helping to heal something is really required, you know. And by just moving on, there's a cruelty in it, you know. You wouldn't do it to your friend, you wouldn't do it to your child, but you'll do it to yourself. Yourself means the complexes or the hurts inside. It doesn't feel right. And sometimes it's absolutely right. But then there's no resistance to it. You know what I mean? That's shama. But shama doesn't always work. And there's dhamma. And that when there's dhamma, it means you can contain it, but then you have to come into relationship with it because it's become embodied in you. Yeah. So. Okay. These three will be on top. These four will be on top tomorrow. Is that good? I could do them all now, but then we'll get too tired, I think. I don't mind doing them. But also, I think it's better not to be for too long at a time. Yeah? Okay, good. Let's say it's so swasti. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Gopramanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parijanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho yam kshobarahitaha Brahmanas santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham sastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om